Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Today, we're listening back to two of our favorite shows from this year so far. Coming up first, we replay an interview that you did, Cherry, about aging and defying the myths of aging as people live longer. Let's listen back to the interview and our great callers from that day.
Today on the show, we're going to break down outdated stereotypes and look at whether it's time to reshape our expectation of what older adulthood could look like. And to help us do this, we have Deborah Carr, an expert on aging and how social policy interacts or intersects with longevity. She is a professor of sociology at Boston University and is author of Aging in America. Debbie, welcome to Studio 2. So nice to see you.
It's nice to see you as well.
And I want to start with a caller to kind of set the scene. Meredith from Garnet Valley is on the line. Meredith, you are in Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I guess my comment is that the importance of your perception and how you perceive yourself, if you perceive yourself as old and no longer capable of doing things, then you won't be able to do them. Of course, the marker of what you perceive as being old seems to get further and further away as you get closer. But
Do you feel your age at all, Meredith?
I do not feel my age, I guess. You know, there are physical changes that come, but I'm often told I don't look my age, and I am continue to be very active. And my husband and I just got back from mountain biking in Nepal, and you know, so you can still be very capable as you age if you take wellness seriously and prevention seriously.
And by the way, I don't mean to put you out there, but our producers say you just turned 60. Happy belated birthday. Mm-hmm. And you're mountain biking in Nepal. That is so cool.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's Meredith from Garnet Valley sharing her perspective on this. And so, Debbie, I want to bring you into the conversation because in 1900, the average U.S. life expectancy I mentioned was 47. Today, it's about 79. Many people live far longer than this. So what did it mean to grow old 100 years ago versus today?
Sure. Well, it was pretty rare to survive until extreme old age 100 years ago, although there were older people. It's kind of a trick looking at those life expectancy statistics. A low life expectancy often is pulled down by infant mortality. So we want to kind of get rid of that notion that there were no old people 100 years ago. But people are living longer and healthier today for a range of reasons. We've had tremendous public health interventions, everything from water fluoridation to pasteurization to many strides in improving the environment. But then likewise, our lifestyles have improved. Rates of smoking are down. People are eating healthier. They're exercising. They're doing jobs that have lower levels of exposure to toxics, right? Less difficult or challenging physical labor jobs. So there are a lot of societal factors that are helping people to live longer, healthier lives.
I just love it. But, you know, I want to talk about this 65 number that had been floating around for more than 100 years. Age 65, it became the American threshold for old age with Social Security in 1935. And at the time, a lot of people didn't reach it at that time. But I want you to kind of explain to us, how did 65 just become this number for all of us? Was it anything based in science for us to kind of say 65 is when you're, quote, old and ready for retirement?
Yeah, you know, you're right that age 65 as being the marker of old age is largely arbitrary. You know, it came about for Social Security because it was an age at which, you know, was the average age at which people would retire. But we know that some people retire much younger. We know that people who have had very difficult lives don't have a body that allows them to work at 65. But then there are plenty of other people, you know, professors and doctors and lawyers who have sedentary work. We can stay in our jobs until we're 80 or 85. So you're right that 65 is arbitrary and it's just a number. And in fact, most of us have multiple ages. We have our chronological age, but then as our caller just told us, it's how old we feel, how old we look, how old other people think we are. So we really need to move away from this simplistic notion that someone becomes old magically on their 65th birthday.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller. We have Sally from Montgomery County on the line. Sally, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, hi, everyone.
Hello.
When I was a little girl, we called my dad the old man when he hit 40.
Ooh.
And I am now 67 and still moving and shaking, even though I have a lot of health and things going on. But I wanted to say this. 5 minutes before I heard you guys were on the air, I was with a woman who is of my age, and we ended up talking about her fingers being very arthritic and her hair falling out. She was just diagnosed with alopecia, and she thought both things were due to age. And I went, oh, no, don't think that way. So I called to encourage everybody to not let our medical providers misdirect us or not diagnose us because of age. And I know that your expert there probably has an opinion about that as well.
Yeah, thank you. That is Sally from Montgomery County with a great perspective. And by the way, we invite you to join the conversation. Do you feel your age, and has your idea of aging changed over time? Again, the number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the chat. And so, Debbie, I mean, Sally had a point. I had a doctor's appointment. I'm in my 40s. Go in there. Some things were going on. And they said, oh, this is just something that happens in your 40s. And I said, you got to have a better answer than that. And at every different stage of life, people try to tell you to accept things. Any thoughts on what Sally had to say?
Yes, Sally is absolutely right. That oftentimes people will think that, you know, dementia or being depressed or having aches and pains is just a normal part of getting old. And that's not actually true, right? Many people live until 90 with relatively few symptoms, with their mind intact. And so we want to make sure that when we go to the doctor, we're really clear that the symptoms we have are not typical. And that's part of the reason why they require treatment. We can't kind of blithely attribute everything to age. You know, we like to say we have senior moments, but often it's just we're distracted or have too many things in our minds. So I think Sally's absolutely right. We want to kind of challenge this notion that old age equals frail and sick.
And that has been the big, you know, cultural and just societal impression that, you know, old age comes with decline. It comes with withdrawal from society and all those things. And it seems like there has been a shift, especially with the baby boomer generation. Folks are sort of shifting the narrative. Can you talk about how cultural view of what aging means and sort of like the subtle cues that go along with that can impact your mindset on how you see yourself as you age?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing we also need to remember is that some things improve with age. Knowledge and wisdom and experience. So getting older is not synonymous with decline. And you're absolutely right that generations, you know, baby boomers and now the aging generation X, you know, my cohort really is reinventing aging. We see people starting new businesses in their 50s and 60s or running marathons or finding new relationships. And in fact, we see lots of people in their 50s and 60s who have left a relationship that didn't work for them and are dating or cohabiting or remarrying. So I think what the boomers are doing is telling us that you can have a completely new lease on life, new adventures, new challenges, even going back to school at older ages. And frankly, if someone's 65 today and they're in pretty good health, they will very well survive until 85 or 90. And just think about that. At 65, we're not kind of hanging things up, but we might have 20 plus years ahead that we can live out in the ways that we would like to live it, you know, contingent on our minds and our bodies being in shape to do those things we'd like to do.
Yeah, I want to read a comment from Miles from Germantown who says he wants us to talk about the privilege of aging and how people in Chestnut Hill grow older than people in Nicetown. He thinks that some people have better access to health care and therefore live longer. And I want to kind of sharpen what Miles had to say, because you think about babies, right? There's like these milestones that babies across all, you know, demographics are supposed to reach. You're supposed to be walking and talking and doing things at certain stages. But it's different with aging. People can age at different rates. And there's a lot of different factors that go into that. And it goes into what Miles had to say. That's, you know, and like zip code could be part of that. Can you tell us some of the factors that can contribute to how you age over time?
Sure. And Miles is absolutely right. And in my research, this is one of the topics I write about and actually care about most deeply. Living to age 65 is a luxury for some communities. We know that there's economic disadvantage in this country. We know there's certainly racial oppression. There is climate injustice. And so if someone has the ill fortune to not have a lot of money and they don't have access to health care, they live in a neighborhood that's highly polluted, they will die younger. They'll have earlier onset of health problems, and they might not survive long enough to get Social Security or Medicare. And so this is something really important. There's a huge social justice component to aging. There's also something that scientists refer to as accelerated aging, kind of what you just referenced, that the age at which we start to experience symptoms, everything from diabetes to heart disease to cognitive decline, it tends to happen earlier and at younger ages for people who have faced more challenges in life and reduced access to healthcare or dangerous jobs. So he's absolutely right in saying growing old is an absolute luxury of economic privilege and racial privilege in this country.
I wonder how much the genetics plays in part. I mean, nature, you know, versus nurture type of thing. You talked about the zip code and what you eat and what you're exposed to. But, you know, if everybody in your family lives to be 100, I mean, do you have how much does that contribute? And can you, or if everybody in your family doesn't, you know, how does that, you know, change the numbers?
Yeah, you know, genes are very complex. And I know we like to say, oh, I lived to 100 because, you know, my grandmother did. It's good genes. You know, there are a couple things going on. Genes matter more for the health problems that we acquire earlier in life. So, you know, childhood diabetes, for instance. But the power of genes as a risk factor for health actually diminish over time. And one of the reasons is called gene-environment interaction. If you're alive for 70 or 80 years, there are so many other ways that the social environment and access to healthcare can kind of affect our lives, that genes have kind of diminishing power over time. And that's not to say they don't matter, right? We know there are some diseases that have a really high heritability, right? A very high kind of genetic influence. But a very famous study that was published in New England Journal of Medicine actually attributes, you know, mortality and survival a very small fraction relatively to genes. And most of the other factors are environment, health behaviors, and access to care. So genes matter, but they're not deterministic. They actually intersect with our environment. And you can have a bad gene, but if you have a healthy lifestyle, that can help to kind of buffer a little bit of that genetic risk.
Yeah, you can beat the odds there. And for our listeners at home, I invite you to join the conversation. The question is, do you feel your age, and has your idea of aging changed over time? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, keep those comments coming. By the way, David on YouTube says, OMG, by the time we're 150 years old, people will be living until 200 years old. And they just might. You never know. Ruby comments, I celebrated my 70th birthday this past weekend. I am blessed with good health. I work out 3 days a week with a trainer and walk 12 to 15 miles per week. I need to walk with you, Ruby, because you're doing it. And answering the question, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you were? She says, mentally and physically very young. I want to bring in a caller. We have Kimberly from Collingswood, New Jersey on the line. Kimberly, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that I retired early because too many of my colleagues were dying before they hit 65. So I retired 10 years early. And I'm pledged to do two things. One was to do something every day that brought me joy.
Ooh.
But the other thing that's most important is sleep. As you get older, it's harder to sleep and it takes work. And I encourage everybody to do that work. If you need a new mattress, get it. You know, follow the advice about putting your electronics away. I use a half a gummy to make sure that I get at least 6 or 7 hours
of sleep a
night.
What's in that gummy?
It's so important. Yes, it's directly related to how quickly you age.
I love it. Kimberly, and what's in that gummy?
I use the mix of the THC and CBD.
Okay.
And like I said, a half of one does the trick. And, you know, it's not that expensive. So it's worth it, especially if I stayed up too late watching television and really need to get to sleep. It always works.
Well, thank you so much, Kimberly from Collingswood, New Jersey, talking about the you know, the need for, to have good sleep to keep you healthy and age well. I love that. And I think there's a lot of factors you can do to make aging better. And I know that sleep can help. Getting good sleep can help stave off dementia and so many other illnesses and keep your immune system strong. Can you piggyback on what Kimberly have to say and talk about the necessity for good quality sleep?
Yeah, sleep is so important at any age, but especially for older people. And Kimberly's absolutely right. There are a lot of reasons why sometimes it's hard to get a good night's sleep with age. If you have more aches and pains, it's harder to sleep. For people unlike Kimberly and a lot of our callers, for those who aren't physically active during the day, it's a lot harder to fall asleep.
Yeah.
And then there's really interesting research on, you know, partner sleeping, right? If someone has a partner who has prostate health problems, for instance, and you're getting up and going to the bathroom several times during the night, that will affect their co-sleeper, right, as we tend to call them. And so sleeping is affected by not only what we do during the day, but for those who do have a partner, their sleep habits also can kind of make our lives or our nights more or less restless.
Well, Avi, as you could probably hear, I love these conversations and especially all the comments and questions that we got that day from our Studio 2 listeners.
Gotta love the listeners.
Gotta love them. Well, we have to take a short break. And when we come back, we get into how aging isn't as gradual as you might think and how our perception of aging has changed thanks to pop culture. Think Golden Girls versus Carrie Bradshaw. Stick with us. There's lots to come. This is Studio 2.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we rebroadcast some of our favorite shows from this year so far. Before the break, you heard from our guest, Deborah Carr, professor of sociology at Boston University and author of the book, Aging in America.
Now, Cherry, before the break, you said you were going to talk about how aging isn't gradual. What's that all about?
Well, Avi, it was actually one of our Studio Tubers who sparked that conversation. And I'd say, let's just jump right back into it. Dandelion asked, can you speak to the idea of aging in spurts rather than gradually? And I've read something about this, that there are sections of your life where you have a little bit of a, you age, but it's not like you're aging, you know, every single day, but there's like sections. Is that true? Can you explain how aging actually happens?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I haven't actually seen like hard data on this, but we know there is some developmental periods like adolescence, for instance, where there's a whole concentration of physical changes. Another one might be menopause. And we know that menopause is a very protracted period. It's not like one day, but it can be as long as, you know, 10 years between perimenopause through the whole thing. And there are periods where you have a concentration of things going on in your body. So that definitely happens. But another is that there are social factors that might make us feel like we're having a whole bunch of age-related questions at once. And the main social factor is stress, right? Mm-hmm. When we're stressed, we get headaches, we don't have time to exercise, our sleep is disrupted. So you can think about sleep as being kind of this, you know, rolling stone that's getting bigger and bigger, and we tend to get more symptoms and we don't really treat them as well when we're having a period of stress. Our diet's not good, our sleep's not good, we don't exercise, we feel lousy. So there could be, again, particular moments where we feel a lot going on, and it's less the aging process per se, but more this kind of range of accumulating factors that's making our life more difficult.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller. We have Zoya from Quakertown on the line. Zoya, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that you really do have to work at enjoying your life and honoring your health, especially if you have it. I'm 75. I'm active every day, yoga, biking, kayaks, weights. I'm still working as a freelancer, and I value my activity and my quiet time as well. Another important issue is gut health. I had very bad acid reflux, GERD. And what I didn't realize is until I found probiotics that helped, it included inflammation. So I was moving like a very old person until I was able to solve that. But your state of mind is important. I have two 90-year-old friends.
Wow.
That are very involved with life. They're sharp as a tack. They attend classes and give to the community. And I'm going on Thursday to visit another friend's 105-year-old mother who lives in a facility but is active and even made videos encouraging people to vote last November. So being involved and being active and honoring whatever health we have is very important.
I love that. That's Zoya from Quakertown. And feel free to join the conversation. Our questions of the day are this. Do you feel your age? Has your idea of aging changed over time? The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube, keep those comments coming in the chat. I want to set something up with you, Debbie, because I want to talk about culture and a little bit of pop culture. And we have a couple clips we want to play because our cultural narrative around aging and how it has really shifted, I think, over the past 40 or so years. I want to play this first clip. It's from The Golden Girls, the show that everybody loved. Thank you for being a friend. Remember that? Anyway.
I love that show.
in this 1985 episode of The Golden Girls, Dorothy and Rose talk about feeling young, but not looking young. Take a listen.
I was in the teacher's lounge talking to a group of girls in their 20s. Oh, they were so pretty. At that age, you don't even have to be pretty and you're pretty. Anyway, we were laughing and giggling and having a great time, and I completely forgot that I was older. You know, I just felt like one of the girls, and we had a wonderful time. And then I got into my car and caught a glimpse of myself, and I almost had a heart attack. This old woman was in the mirror. I didn't even recognize her.
And I want to put this up against fast forward to today, the show, and Just Like That. It's the new HBO Max series, the sequel to Sex and the City, here where Carrie Bradshaw and her friends talk about menopause in a New York diner. Take a listen.
Well, I think I'm done.
Mentioning it?
No, done. I haven't gotten my period in 4 months, so I think I'm finally in menopause.
Welcome to the club.
Prepare to be sweaty.
And you know, I see these two differences. First of all, just the way women looked, you know, in 1985 versus in 2025 or 2024, whenever this was shot, just sort of our evolution. Has our understanding of aging, our culture, the pop cultural commentary around aging, has it shifted enough to sort of accommodate the extended lifestyles and the way people are sort of viewing themselves now?
Yeah, and it's funny you chose clips from two of my favorite shows that I watch religiously. Absolutely. I think it has changed a lot, having to do with style, having to do with the kind of jobs people have, even social roles, right? Like Charlotte had a child at an older age, right? So someone might be 55 with a fairly young child today, which makes them younger. Oftentimes, they maybe are the oldest mother in the PTA, but they're with younger moms, which keeps them young. So I think there are a lot of social and cultural factors that emphasize just differences in how we carry ourselves and how we look. But with that said, you know, I'm not wholly optimistic, because if you're a big fan of in Just Like That, a lot of the commentary online was entirely ageist, you know, picking on Charlotte, you know, Kristen Davis for having a facelift, and likewise picking on Sarah Jessica Parker for not having a facelift. So I think women can't win. If they look too young or too old, they're going to be mocked, ridiculed, or critiqued. So I think this is a challenge that continues today.
And so, Debbie, I gotta, you know, talk about this whole industry that has sort of built up around aging and the beauty industry. There's so many industries. This is billions of dollars to help people sort of hide their aging, try to reverse their aging, slow their aging. There's so many things, from hair color to supplements to all sorts of things. Can you talk about sort of this pressure, right, to not just be, and specifically for women, they want you to look like you were 25, even though you may be 55.
Yeah, Absolutely. This whole anti-aging industry makes me a little bit crazy. And this whole notion that you should look 20 when you're 50. I mean, it's preposterous. And, you know, there are these phrases that every wrinkle someone has is a testament to their past and their capacity to overcome challenge. And, you know, I think there are real problems for normalizing an artificial look. And if someone chooses to have plastic surgery or Botox, of course, that's absolutely their right. But I think what we want to do is change the world so that people don't feel they have to look 20 years younger to get ahead. And I say that because we know there's tremendous ageism in hiring, right? Yes. There are women who are divorced at 50 who need to get a job. And we know that they won't be hired if they look older, right? We know that ageism is pervasive and you're more likely to experience ageism if you look older, right? That's the signal that triggers people to be ageist. So we need to make sure that our employers are not ageist and our media is not, and that we treat people well no matter how they look, because we don't want to make people feel that they have to look young or else they're going to be left behind.
Yeah.
And again, no judgment for those who choose to use artificial means, but we shouldn't be forced to do so just to be able to put food on our tables and to have a full and rewarding life.
Yeah. Danielle says online, we are living healthier lives than our parents, mostly because of information and preventative medicine. This has changed my idea of aging. I am older than Blanche Devereaux, Golden Girls, and I'm still confused by that. A lot of people see that, the reference. I think our producer Debbie was like, what? They're only in their 50s? Because the idea of a middle-aged woman in the 80s, totally different. I want to bring in a caller. We have Carrie from Chester County on the line. Carrie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my commentary is that this is a really interesting conversation, and I want to say I am 74 years old. I'm very fortunate. I'm very healthy, and I maintain that health. I work out. I'm very fortunate. I'm financially secure. I still go through bouts of depression. I still have to fight that. And why? Well, I don't have enough friends. I have reconnected with people that I grew up with on the same street, you know, same row house. What I'm trying to get to is it's hard to make friends. Well, my question is, what do you do about those things that can get you down, even when you've got so many things going?
Yeah, thank you so much, Carrie, from Chester County. There are so many layers to this, right? And so can you provide a brief comment to Carrie from Chester County on that? Like, because you may be doing well, you may be healthy, but it does change how you make friends. All of these things, your community changes as you age.
Absolutely. Carrie's absolutely right. And there are some challenges that come with aging. One is parental care. If you're caring for a parent and maybe squabbling with your siblings, if your spouse or partner has health problems. So the reality of aging can be difficult, right? There are a lot of these factors. And, you know, the main way we manage stress is with social support. And that's hard if you feel you don't have sufficient numbers of friends. But I think there are other ways to find new friends that don't have to be your bestie, but it can be a Facebook group or a virtual group that's a support group that focuses on very specific issues, right? And so that way you can talk about caregiving challenges or grappling with depression or swapping ideas. And so just because you don't have friends next door doesn't mean there's not a whole universe of people who can be a source of support, even if they're not your bestie.
And Debbie, I want to get this last question in as we wrap up, because I realize that there's a whole anti-aging activism that is going on. And you only have about 40 seconds, but just sort of how do we fight ageism? And I didn't get to Carol from Doylestown, who was going to give us some advice on this, but I really want people to sort of help change the narrative. How do we take steps in our lives to train people to try to redefine what it means, and so that we can have a more inclusive society as we get to more people being older in our society? And you have 30 seconds.
I think one thing is call it out, just as we would call out racism or sexism, call out ageism. And when you see it happening, hear it happening, letting people know that if they're fortunate enough, they too will someday be 65 or 70 years old. So we need to lead with empathy and recognizing the many strengths that older adults have and hold up images of that successful aging.
Fascinating conversation, Cherry. And also, thanks to our guest, Deborah Carr, professor of sociology at Boston University and author of the book Aging in America. When we come back, we'll talk about the young women on social media embracing a 1950s style vision of homemaking and motherhood. What's the appeal? And who's the audience? We'll be right back. This is Studio 2.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Marriage has evolved a lot over the centuries. The institution used to be less about love and more about financial security and prosperity. Gender roles have also evolved from the days when women's only role was in the home to the 21st century ideal that a woman can have it all.
Yeah, and gender roles and marriage dynamics vary greatly in each relationship. Some households feature two working partners, while others depend on a single income. Although motherhood can present unique challenges, many partners strive to share household responsibilities, and husbands and fathers are increasingly expected to contribute beyond just providing financially.
We discussed the evolution of marriage with two great guests. Joe Piazza is a journalist and author of many books, including the thriller Everyone is Lying to You. And Stephanie Kuntz is director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families and author of the forthcoming For Better and Worse, The Problematic Past and Challenging Future of Marriage. We started our conversation by asking Joe to lay out what exactly trad wives are.
I've been looking at social media influencers, especially mom influencers, for the past 5 years. And in the past couple of years, we've seen the rise of what has been called trad wives, short for traditional wives. And these are women who are kind of cosplaying a nostalgic mashup of what I call June Cleaver meets Laura Ingalls Wilder. So, you know, they're in the kitchen in their fancy dresses. They're beautiful, immaculate kitchens, by the way. But then also running through fields chasing after chickens and milking cows in the same immaculate dresses. Wow. And they seem to be pushing this agenda of traditional gender roles where a woman's place is in the household and a man's place is to be out making the money and supporting the family. They often have many, many children. And by many, I mean in the 6 to 8 to 10 range. And they've gained so much popularity. At first, I thought this was a blip. A blip in the social media universe. But many of these women have millions of followers, and I've interviewed hundreds of young women who follow them who are really taking these ideas to heart, who are saying, look, maybe your version of feminism, climbing the corporate ladder, working outside the home, I'm seeing a lot of women burn out. Maybe that did not work for you. And I think I like this idea of checking out of the workforce. Maybe depending on a man isn't so bad. Maybe I do want to, you know, not continue my education, not try to climb that corporate ladder, and just stay in my kitchen and bake some sourdough bread.
Wow. And so you talked to, you said you talked to hundreds of young women. And so when we think, are they being actually influenced to sort of make life choices based on what they're seeing on social media?
They absolutely are. I have heard from many young women who are like, why am I killing myself to finish this degree when I can just find a man to take care of me and I can make these beautiful recipes and I can make my house gorgeous and I don't have to stress myself out at work like I have seen so many women doing.
I want to read this quote from an anonymous Gen Zer who responded to a call out from BuzzFeed. And this is a quote from apparently a young person. We have very different skill sets than men and we're ready to embrace them as opposed to becoming jealous of men making a lot of money and having influence. We have come to realize that we have influence over our men by being the best wives we can be. We want the old ways back. It worked for thousands of years and then the hippies messed it up.
I saw that quote.
For all of us. Okay, so let me bring you in now, Stephanie Kuntz, because you know the history of all this. Did the hippies mess it up for everybody? Give us the real dope on what marriage was like in the era that these videos are hearkening back to.
Well, first of all, you want to make sure that by traditional, they mean a very short-lived period of American history.
Yeah.
The word male breadwinner wasn't even used until the mid-19th century, because before that time, women were totally co-providers. They did cooking and preserving, not for the family. They took it to the market to sell it or trade. Mm. It was part of their way of providing for the family. So it's not until the 1950s that a majority of children for the first time begin to grow up in families where the wife does not work outside the home or in a farm, and wow. the man brings home the money, and the kids are in school and rather than in the labor force as they were in the past. But at any rate, I don't want to go on too long. Let's let somebody else talk here.
And, yeah, and I think about the 1950s because everybody wasn't living this life, right? Everybody couldn't afford to be stay-at-home moms, and there were reasons, I think, legal reasons, a lot of times why women were kind of sort of set up to be in these more traditional marriages. And Stephanie, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I don't think people really remember that it's only been about 50 years since women have had some semblance of financial independence.
Well, I think it's really important to realize that those 1950s families, first of all, as you said, were not for everyone. You know, there were tremendously high poverty rates then. Black Americans were subject to segregation. And there were two pillars that supported this family for growing numbers of working class Americans in World War II. One was a totally different economic and political situation where there were labor unions, there were much more secure jobs, rising wages, rising real wages. Every generation of young men was making more real wages than his father had made. There were pensions that were guaranteed by, so there was a possibility for someone to support a family on an income. But the other pillar of that was there was no possibility for a woman to do so. They were normally fired when they got married. They had very few rights. And one of the things that scares me about any young women who are being is seduced into thinking that this is a solution to the very real pressures that they face is that women had no guarantee of being able to support themselves. So in other words, it was based upon a very different set of conditions for yep. male workers yes. mm-hmm. and no possibilities and no options for females who wanted to be or had to be self-supporting.
And so, then the pendulum swung the other way. Yeah.
So clearly there is some misremembering going on that's wrapped up in this in this trend. But
yeah.
Joe, you also mentioned this idea that there is an agenda or a movement. And Alair on YouTube says, I like how Joe touched on the tradwife agenda. Mm-hmm. Who does this agenda serve? How is it connected to a larger political agenda, especially the more nuanced tradwife content? Mm-hmm. Because from the stuff that I've seen, the very little that I've seen, oftentimes it seems pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. I'm making Rice Krispies. Yeah. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem political.
It's meant to.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. One of the things that I've discovered in my reporting is that the right has been courting influencers for quite some time, for about a decade. And we know that the left really had Hollywood in their pocket for a long time. And so the right thought, okay, we need our own celebrities. And a lot of those celebrities are influencers. And they have been putting a lot of money behind certain tradwife influencers to push this agenda in a very beautiful, aesthetically pleasing way. And these images, these videos, they can make women participate in their own oppression and say, yeah, why do I need equal pay? Why do I need protections in the workforce? Why do we need paid childcare if this is an easier life for me? Mm. If this is a more idyllic life for me and prettier life for me? And we are seeing a very big conservative agenda on the right being pushed to try to keep these rights from women, to roll back rights for women, much as Stephanie talked about in the 1950s, when we saw these housewives, and again, the housewives were such a small sliver of the actual population,
right.
because who could afford that? The interesting truth is, most people can't afford it now either. Mm-hmm. We are in a precarious economy, and most families cannot be supported on a single income.
Right, right.
These days.
Yeah. And by the way, we want to mention that we did reach out to about a dozen tradwife mm-hmm. influencers, but none were able to join us today. So we did try to include yeah. that perspective as well. And I want to talk about why we've sort of like fantasized this. And you touched on it a little bit, Joe, because, you know, a lot of these young people, they talk about how they saw their moms, you know, working super hard mm-hmm. and they felt like a burden. And so they wanted to find a way to have a different life and be, have a different version for their kids. Can you talk about some of the psychology involved as to why some young women are very attracted to this?
Yeah, it makes so much sense. Okay, we saw a lot of women go into the workforce, be the girl bosses, and burn out. Because even though we raised our daughters, much as Gloria Steinem has said many times, you know, to be those bosses, to be a different kind of woman, we didn't raise sons to accommodate that. And so I don't think that we trained men or corporate America in ways to support women, to support working mothers. And it has been incredibly hard to try to have it all, to juggle all the things. I've burnt out. I worked in magazines for a long time, and I watched all of my colleagues a couple years older than me struggling to have kids, to have a family, to do it all. I get why women would want to check out of that system. Mm. But as Stephanie said, the answer cannot be to give complete autonomy and agency over to your husband, because at the end of the day, we all need a safety net and we all need financial protections. And I like to be very clear about one thing, too, when I talk about trad wives. Stay-at-home moms are not trad wives. Stay-at-home moms are the CEOs of their households. Mm. And the majority of those are equal partnerships. My issue with this false nostalgia for a more quote-unquote traditional time is that it is oppressing for women, that we are saying that women shouldn't have their own money, their own education, or their own safety net outside of their husband.
French Doc on YouTube agrees, says mm-hmm. it's never a good idea to encourage financial dependence. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine, you know, if we did have one of those influencers here, they might say, look, I am celebrating the work in the domestic mm-hmm. space, this work that gets dismissed by everybody else. I'm putting it front and center and celebrating it and showing that it can be beautiful and that it's meaningful. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that true, Joe? I mean, is there?
I do think that's true. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that there is a lot of merit in that, because I will say that, you know, for the past 20, 30 years, feminism has dismissed the work that is in the home as well. And we need to acknowledge that if we want that work to be acknowledged universally by men and women. I love that they are elevating the work in the home. I want them to admit a few things as well, mm-hmm. though, because these influencers are making money. I know that they are making millions of dollars, the top influencers.
So they're working.
They are working. Mm-hmm. And that's why I called the book Everyone is Lying to You. It started as a satire, but they are working. Many of their husbands have quit their jobs in order to work for them. And yet they're saying, look at me, I am just a traditional wife. You know, I'm just a housewife.
You don't like the deception. You think there's a deception at the core of it.
I don't like the deception, because it makes it seem like all of this is easy. And nothing about raising children, keeping a home or marriage is easy. I do not like that all of the labor is stripped out of it.
Stephanie, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I do. I don't want us to think that so too many people are totally buying into this. I think it's important to recognize that some of this is just sort of a way of relaxing. Yes, there are many people with the kind of right-wing agenda that Joe talked about. But the fact is that most, we know what works in marriages today, that women expect more equality from marriage. Most women do. And there's tremendous research that shows that marriages in which men and women both share income earning and childcare and housework and share it equally, getting it back to the Eve Rodsky fair mm-hmm. play cards, which I can explain in a minute to you, those are the ones that grow more happy over time. The other ones, even when they start out very loving, tend to get more discontented over time. So women who might enjoy this for a few years get tired of it after a while.
Is there a way to like break the cycle of what we've all inherited from the culture that came before us?
Yes, there is. But it is true that it takes a while to do that. I mean, we've had a lot of indoctrination into these male and female roles, even though they weren't traditional. The traditional division of labor between men and women was not one where women just picked up and cleaned toilets and did that kind of really kind of work that never gets praised. They made beer, they made bacon, they took it. It had its own rewards. Mm. So what we got in the 50s, as soon as work moved out of the home and men began to buy the things that had been made before, women were stuck with the most routine difficult jobs that don't get praised, that don't get any, and that have to be done over and over again. And so nowadays, when we look at what we think were traditional male tasks and female tasks, the female ones are often much more onerous, much more boring, and much more complicated than the men actually realize. And that's why there's a lot of research that shows that dividing the chores in ways that do not assume that all women are good at this and men are good at that, mm-hmm. but that allow you to share or alternate or pick and choose, you know, like in my family, I do like to do the dishes. I like to cook. So I do the cooking. But I figure if I do the cooking, then, and I ask him to crawl under the household to get for the, you know, the stink down there from the animal that died out in the country, then I should probably do the cleanup after the kitchen as well. And so there's a lot of way. I mean, really, men are doing a lot more than they used to do.
Yeah.
One of the real critical ways that people find, and this is really interesting in terms of the trad wives who are just wives and don't have kids, is the real tensions come with the arrival of children, because it's impossible to do that totally equally.
Right.
Yeah. And Stephanie, let me read a few comments here, because I think we have a couple of men commenting. Kevin says, I am a way better housewife than my female partner. She is far better equipped to work outside the home, earning a high enough wage than I am, a higher enough wage than I am. And he says, these are the only reasons to live this life. And so he clearly, in their marriage or their relationship, she's the earner and he keeps house there. Nelson says they split the duties. He says, for cooking, my wife preps and starts soups, etc., but always asks me to touch it up with spices. So Nelson brings the spice. And Sue says, there is some work that is split on gender lines in my house. No kids, both retired now. He does outside work, lawn mowing, etc. I do bills and laundry. He does dishes. We both neglect deep cleaning of the house. Yes. And so, you know, I just want to sort of talk about this whole evolution of gender roles and the images we see.
Yes.
Because when I was growing up, Claire Huxtable was an image that I had. And you know, she was a working mother. She was a lawyer. She had 5 children. And she made sure her husband didn't eat too many hoagies.
She did it all.
And she did a lot.
She did. And we'll never get into the Bill Cosby of it all. We only talk about Claire.
Yeah, we only talk about Claire.
We only talk about Claire. Exactly.
But I mean, yes. And then the you know, we saw the.
So are you saying there was something damaging in that portrayal? Because
no,
it was unrealistic?
No,
it was.
The 80s were better. The 80s culturally were so much better. We mm-hmm. also had Who's the Boss?
Yes.
Angela.
Yes.
Angela was going out at her big advertising job.
Yeah.
And Tony Danza was cleaning the house.
But I'm just, and these images have sort of evolved now. And now,
see, I don't think we see them as much as we did in the 80s.
Yeah.
I think culturally, we're seeing less and less of that equal division of labor on our screens and in our pop culture.
Stephanie, do you have anything to add to sort of how women are educated on what a wife is supposed to be?
Well, I think that one of the things in popular culture is that there is an attempt to show that women can do all the things that men can do. We've got kick-ass women out there, you know, martial experts and, you know, all sorts of things like that. But there has not been the same emphasis, I agree with Joe, on showing that men can do all the things that women were supposed to do in the 50s.
Yeah, that is true.
And that's what we need.
By the way, Christine emails and says, as a proud Gen Xer, I need to comment. I just got out of a 20-year marriage with a supposedly progressive man who ended up resenting and putting me down for having a career. When I began that career, he resented my lack of time spent with him and taking care of the home, so our marriage failed. And now she has an older partner who has offered that for her to be a stay-at-home person, because he can easily afford it. However, she has a small business and decided to continue with that. And so I want to sort of talk about the fact that, you know, sometimes women get tired. And I think, you know, having this choice. So how do you sort of negotiate this? If we want to give people advice, this is something you don't really think about till you're in it. You're
no,
a wife.
Of course not.
And you're like, so how do I negotiate this? How do I choose? How do I decide what's right for me? And I don't know, Stephanie, if you want to add this, because, you know, young women are coming up. They're seeing this. They want to make decisions about their life. They have no idea what it's going to be. But how do you make those decisions?
Well, I mean, it just has to be that we start talking about what we want in relationships, and we talk about that during the formation of the relationship, not after you've already.
What do you need?
What do you need? What do you want? And also, I think being really open and honest about money. Okay, if you're the one making the money, okay, are you setting up a 401k for me if you ever leave? Because like Kate said, men die and they divorce you. Okay, so like it cannot be your ultimate plan if you don't have a safety net. And I think we also have to be more accommodating of the fact that it can be hard to work and to be a mother, and accommodating of career pauses and women going back into the workforce and having work experience and education so that they can do that if worst case scenario does happen. It is like Stephanie said, it's a lot about communication up front and being really open and honest. What do you want? How do you want me to be in a marriage? Because once you have kids, it just gets harder and harder to negotiate those things.
What a great hour, Cherry. Yeah. It was a blast. We should also mention, before we say goodbye to our listeners, that Joe Piazza's new thriller, Everyone is Lying to You, was released last month. So go check it out.
And we want to thank our team, producers Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, Andreas Copes, Mike Schiffler, and Kevin McCory. Also, thank you to our engineer for today, Al Banks, and to WHYY's audio general manager, Joan Isabella. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.